The following program is made possible with support from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Tvameva Mata Cha Pita Tvameva Tvameva Bandhu Cha Sakha Tvameva Tvameva Vidya Dravinam Tvameva Tvameva Sarvam Mama Deva Deva.
We have our ancient tradition. Thousands of years ago, we had small village republics. The British deliberately broke this tradition in order to strengthen their own hold on the country. In the times of the Maurya Guptas, the Pathan, the Mughals, the Peshwas, there were village panchayats in virtually every village. Gandhiji said that Swaraj means Ram Raj. Swaraj means that every village will have its own rule. Every village, every muhalla, and every town will manage its own affairs. What they must not do is just hand over the lot to their representatives to get it all done at a higher level.
Normally what happens is that people go to the polls and elect a party to rule for 5 years. And after that, there is absolutely no involvement of the people. People do not have any opportunity to participate in the working of the democratic institution. And it is absolutely necessary that at various stages, the people are involved not only in decision-making, but also in the task of implementing the decisions taken, implementing the plans. Then only it would be called participatory democracy.
Passages to India, a series created by Julian Crandall-Hollick. India has proved surprisingly fertile ground for democracy, and Indian voters have shown a remarkable capacity to use their vote intelligently and effectively. Indian democracy has its share of problems. Threats of secession in Punjab, Kashmir and elsewhere, corruption, nepotism and disregard for democracy's institutions. But these are indictments of politicians, not of the system. And Indian voters have proven time and again that they will not put up with politicians who fail to deliver the goods. Our program is called Ram Rajya, In Search of Democracy.
Millions of them are illiterate. Some have never left their villages. But 2 days ago, they set out on foot or by bullock cart to reach the polling booth in the nearby town. There, they meet old friends, talk into the night, drink innumerable cups of tea, and finally cast their paper ballots before beginning the long haul back home. Some call an Indian election campaign the greatest show on earth, It may well be the noisiest. The staple of Indian campaigns are loudspeakers mounted on cars, rickshaws, even elephants, and monster outdoor rallies where thousands are trucked in from the countryside. Upwards of 500,000 came to this one in Lucknow. It's important that the candidate be seen in the flesh by the voter. Failing that, trucks mounted with giant 8-foot portable screens tour the villages, showing specially filmed campaign videos of the candidate. Elections in India spawn a whole subculture of songs and street plays, imaginative, often scatological. They tell you much more about the mood of the electorate than the ubiquitous opinion polls. Violence, plenty of that, verbal and the other sort. Yet in a curious way, it's a sign of health, of the exuberance, the vibrancy of Indian democracy, of the passionate attachment of Indians to the right to vote, to throw out the rascals and give a new lot a chance to see if they can do any better.
I am never completely satisfied with my work or my vigilance in carrying out public affairs. No task is more important to me than promoting the well-being of all the people. Such work as I accomplish contributes to discharging the debt I owe to all living creatures to make them happy in this world and to help them attain heaven in the next.
These are the words of Ashok Maurya, the first great ruler of what might be called a unified India. Ashok was a convert to Buddhism and tried to put the Buddha's ideas into practice. Throughout India, he had erected vast rock pillars inscribed with maxims that expressed his will to rule benignly and with tolerance for all. Ashok Maurya was not a democrat. He was an enlightened ruler who instinctively realized two things, that a wise king is one who tries to serve his people, and that this meant respecting the religious and cultural diversity of India.
Look, India has within it at least 2,500 major languages. It has more than 2,000 major castes. It has nearly all the world's major religions represented within it.
Ashish Nandi is a sociologist in New Delhi. Ashish says it's the sheer weight of this diversity that forces Indians to learn to live with each other.
And if by democracy you mean management of chaos, management of diversities, management of differences in religions, languages, caste, creeds, and so on and so forth, of various kinds, then India has lived with these differences and learned to manage them for at least the last 1500 years.
If you want somebody to respect your right to be different, you have to do the same back to them. Then you're at least halfway to becoming democratic. And perhaps this is why democracy feels natural to so many Indians.
Because it is an inherently diverse and plural society. A society that has, over the centuries, survived precisely by sustaining and in a way supporting the diversities.
Rajnik Attar is a political scientist, an advocate for many of India's voluntary self-help associations. He's also become a member of India's Planning Commission, putting his ideas into practice.
A democratic ethos is almost natural to such a society. It's unlike pluralism in the West, which is basically political pluralism, this is a socially plural society.
Religiously plural, ethnically plural, linguistically plural. India's about as intricate a multi-ethnic, multinational society as they make them. Any rule that tries to deny this diversity cannot work.
That is why the authoritarian ways, whenever they've been worked out, like Mrs. Gandhi's emergency, immediately turns unstable. Because you are then alienating a whole set of those diversities through which your original unity was built.
Mahatma Gandhi instinctively knew that pluralism was the only way to express India's differences and contradictions. The Congress Party was an amalgam of regional and ideological diversities held together by the goal of Indian independence. The late Romesh Thapa was one of India's leading political journalists.
Even before the transfer of power, it was clear to the leadership of this Freedom Party that India was an extremely complex and contradictory land. And the only way of ruling effectively was through a democratic system, which would give adequate representation and weightage to the various communities, tribes, castes in the country.
After independence, Gandhiji said that the Congress should be dissolved because it has served its purpose and there should be separate political parties. But nobody listened to him.
D.N. Mittal is a former speaker of the State Parliament of Uttar Pradesh. Gandhi didn't believe in political parties. He wanted local self-government through consensus. However, Nehru believed a national party, the Congress Party, was needed to promote change at all levels. D.N. Mittal says this also created its share of problems.
Ideologically, except the Communist Party, there was no other ideological party here. And the splinter groups came out of the Congress. The socialists came first. But, you see, they spoke the same language almost what the Congress was speaking. People couldn't make a distinction between the Congress ideology and the other political parties.
And this still holds true today. Politicians form parties not because of ideology, but as vehicles for patronage. Well, does any of this really matter? Japan, for instance, seems to have developed pretty well under virtual one-party rule. But almost 40 years of Congress rule in India has invited complacency, corruption, and a disrespect for democracy, both within its own ranks and within the country at large. If competition is an essential condition of democracy, because it gives importance to an individual's vote, then perhaps the collapse of the Congress Party in the Nehru-Gandhi dynasty leaves the way clear at last for genuine party competition. So far from deploring the inherent instability that comes with the stridency of a multi-party system, I think we should probably welcome it. It may breathe life back into a system that was in danger of suffocating from its own complacency. In June 1975, Indian democracy did in fact come close to collapsing.
India is already under a state of emergency, but that emergency is against an external threat. This emergency is against an internal threat, i.e. Mrs. Gandhi is now saying that the enemies of India are inside the country. She has said that
Indira Gandhi, faced with strikes and mounting opposition to her rule, suspended the constitution. For 18 months she ruled by decree. This period is known as the emergency, and it's really the watershed of Indian politics. It suddenly brought home to Indians the fragility of democracy. It probably also taught today's voters not to romanticize authoritarian rule as an alternative to democracy.
To what extent does the shadow of the emergency still loom over people's minds as this could happen again so easily?
The shadow is, in a certain sense, ever-present. The emergency is a chapter in Indian politics which no politically sensitive person has yet forgotten.
Zoya Hassan teaches at Jawaharlal Nehru University in Delhi. Most people doubt any government could just flat out declare an emergency nowadays.
It is possible to have the emergency creep in different ways, through different acts of parliament and so on and so forth, which restrict and restrain and curb and in a certain sense modify political freedom.
Could the emergency happen again? Justice V.P. Tatkunda, one of India's leading civil libertarians, thinks that's unlikely.
it will be more difficult to impose an emergency or emergency conditions today than it was in 1975 because of the changes which have taken place in the meantime, the experience that the people have gone through, and greater appreciation of the importance of civil liberties on the part of the people themselves.
Several opposition leaders criticized the government for its economic and political policies and what they called its failure on different fronts. Speakers stressed that a mere change of government is pointless unless they have programs to benefit the common people.
India has always rejoiced in a free press. But when Mrs. Gandhi declared the emergency in 1975, much of the press rolled over, waiting to be tickled. Arun Shuri is editor of India's largest English-language daily, The Express.
The Indian press had been asked to bend, and it had chosen to crawl. I find that a large part of the Indian press today, out of greed and not out of fear, is again playing the legitimizer and apologist for the authorities. But that's not because India is not free or the press is not free, but because they choose to be servile.
Shuri was imprisoned by Mrs. Gandhi during the emergency. He typifies a new type of political journalism, one that refuses to accept the pablum the government often hands out. High-quality weekly magazines now probe corruption and social evils. India's government can no longer count on a compliant press. It's the price they have to pay for the emergency. Governments have secrets, some of them unsavory, and the press becomes an enemy. In 1988, the government closed Shuri's newspaper down for a month, and other newspaper owners have been pressured to fire editors critical of the government of the day.
The conditions for freedom are there. The bulk of the press in India does not choose to exercise the freedom which it can under those conditions. The state certainly tries to make an example of some papers from time to time.
The advent of television brought the issue of a free press to a head. Under Rajiv Gandhi, state-run television became synonymous with the type of sycophancy usually seen in somewhere like North Korea. Now, state-run television and radio will be partially insulated from direct government interference. It's unlikely that any government will ever again try to manipulate television quite so blatantly, or be allowed to get away with it. I wish I could be as optimistic about corruption. The entire political system seems to run on nepotism, bribes and black money. A businessman wants a license to build a factory, become exclusive importer of a hot new product. He gets it at a price, millions of rupees into the party coffers. There are many causes of corruption, sadly inevitable. Low salaries, making ends meet, consumer goodies, greed, dowry. They're by no means unique to India or the Third World, but they strike a particularly raw nerve amongst those who cling to the ideals of the Mahatma.
We have forgotten completely the ideological principles for which we fought.
Scandal and corruption are the prerogative of no one party. D.N. Mittal says all the political parties have betrayed Gandhi's message.
He said that when it comes for your own matter of your own salaries and allowances, don't forget that you represent the poor man who has nothing to eat and nothing to wear. You are his representative. Every pie that you spend upon yourself comes from his pocket.
In a peculiar way, India is a natural place for operating democratic institutions. And what is upsetting it all is centralization of the whole polity into one place, which was not at all the case in traditional India.
Rajni Kothari believes the real threat to Indian democracy lies elsewhere, in trying to create an India modelled on the West.
An India that is keen to put tradition behind and move towards modernity, an India that wants to homogenize its values, its culture, an India that wants to have a lifestyle and a consumer pattern which is common, an India that is turning into a money market, an India that is sort of wanting to be in the export circuit, an India that wants to be integrated into the global market. And the more you do these kinds of things, the more you harm and hurt the basic diversities and multi-ethnicity of this society.
Ashish Nandi puts it even more starkly.
The Indian elites love India. They only dislike the Indians. It is for the sake of India that they are trying to sacrifice the Indians. They want to do to the Indians what they feel the West did to them. And they feel that exactly as the way the West tried to civilize them, tried to push them up the ladder of progress, they must do the same thing to their own people. They must somehow push them towards a better future defined by themselves. They are uncomfortable with the Indian as he lives and as he leads his day-to-day life. They want Indians to be some other people.
If you think he's exaggerating, listen to this well-known Indian politician.
The attitudes of the majority of our people are, well, wrong.
Former Prime Minister Rajiv Gandhi, speaking in 1988.
The most important aspect, I think, is a state of mind. The key is really a change in the attitudes of our people. That's the most important. They don't have enough initiative.
India has the world's third largest scientific and technological manpower. India is the world's 8th or 10th largest industrial power. India itself is the world's, could be world's 5th largest country. And so on and so forth. There is that India. And there is the India of the survivors who are trying to survive the modern India.
Sanjay Gandhi, Mrs. Gandhi's younger son and political heir, who was killed in a flying accident in 1980, wanted India to become like Singapore or Brazil or South Korea. But what John Kenneth Galbraith once called the functioning anarchy of the country got in Sanjay's way. And Sanjay's impatience, and then Rajiv's, may have signalled something else.
See, if you want to give sufficient scope to the culture in India, then you have to have a lot of confidence in a decentralized way of running your affairs. Our problem is not with an insecure populace, it is with an insecure elite.
Ashish Nandi, Rajni Kothari and many others believe most of the political problems afflicting India stem from this attempt to shove the unruly plurality of India into the straitjacket of a homogenous nation-state. There's no flexibility in a straitjacket, and governing India cries out for elastic, not steel. As dawn breaks over the city of Amritsar, priests are already singing hymns inside the Golden Temple, the holiest shrine for Sikhs all over the world. Twice in the past 10 years, this serene setting has echoed to the sound of modern warfare. In June 1984, much of the Golden Temple was destroyed as the Indian Army used tanks and mortars to defeat Sikh militants holed up inside the hundreds of rooms lining the heart of the Golden Temple complex. Over 1,700 people died in the siege. In May 1988, the scene repeated itself. But this time, the army was careful not to desecrate the temple. They starved militants into surrender. As the Sikh historian Kushwant Singh says, some Sikhs still feel cheated for what happened to Punjab in 1947.
After partition and division of the country, Sikhs felt more grieved because they suffered more than any other community. Half of them were in Pakistan and half on this side. And from being the richest peasantry, we came out to a man from Pakistan in much reduced circumstances, and then the grievance grew up. You know, with independence, Hindus got Hindustan, Muslims got Pakistan, Sikhs got Damol.
Punjab was further subdivided in 1966, and Punjab's capital, Chandigarh, is now held in common with the new state of Haryana. Since that time, all Sikhs, moderates and separatists alike, have demanded the return of Chandigarh and an end to the sharing of their rivers for irrigation with other states. New Delhi liked to hem and haw about these demands. And to strengthen the Congress Party in Punjab, Indira Gandhi's followers encouraged the rise of a fundamentalist preacher called Sant Bindranwale. Now, Bindranwale wasn't interested in irrigation waters or the return of Chandigarh. He wanted an independent Sikh state governed according to Sikh religious teachings. Kushwant Singh believes the rise of Bindranwale also expressed a deep-seated fear of the loss of the Sikh identity.
The basic point to bear in mind to understand a man like Bindranwale is this, that the orthodox elements of the Sikh community realized or felt that the Sikhs were disappearing as a separate community. The young Sikh was beginning to get rid of his beard and long hair and didn't understand why it was necessary to be a Sikh to have all this.
By June 1984, Bindranwale was using the sanctuary of the Golden Temple to shelter his armed supporters when they fled there after sorties against moderate Sikhs. Indira Gandhi ordered the army to attack the Golden Temple. Bindranwale died in that siege. Moderate and extremist Sikhs were shocked. Some Sikh recruits in the army deserted. And 4 months later, Mrs. Gandhi was assassinated by her Sikh bodyguards.
She was playing with fire in the Punjab. And she did. I kept warning her about what she was contemplating in Amritsar. And she ignored my warning. For years she kept saying no intention of touching the Golden Temple. And then she did. And she paid, not only she, the entire country is still paying the price for what she did.
At times, it seems as if India is steadily being nibbled away at the edges. In the east, the Nagas, the Assamese, the Gurkhas, the Bodos, and several other ethnic groups all want more autonomy, more identity, more control over their own affairs. In the northwest, apart from the Sikhs, some Kashmiris are pressing for independence from the Indian Union. Saddam is a boatman on Lake Dal, near the Kashmiri capital, Srinagar.
We are so afraid for that. You know, yeah. God has bred, you are Christian, maybe, right? You trust, church, right? I trust, mosque, pray mosque, something like that. Huh? But if I did something in church, you'll be afraid. Why not? You are true.
So are you afraid of the Hindus?
We are afraid. Why should they making like that? You see, we are in Kashmir. We born off in Kashmir. We are, my father is my grandfather in Kashmir. But I did not do like that. Nobody else did like that. There is at least population 95 Muslim, 5% Hindu. We did not touch with them anything. We did not burn his, temple. No, why? This is good.
Maulvi Farooq of the Awami Action Committee knew what he wanted, complete autonomy, which could lead to independence. When he talked about India, he meant a separate and foreign country, the other side of the mountains.
The guarantees given under the Constitution regarding the special status of the state, that is the relevant question at present, for which we are struggling.
Even a moderate politician like Mir Kasim wanted more autonomy, more identity within a truly federal India.
I do not agree with that concept, which is a mostly modern West concept of secular concept, that India should have a uniform core. I feel India is a multilinguistic, multireligious, multicultural entity, and various entities must allow to flower in their own way, and then a federating India will be more strong than a uniform India.
The doomsayers in New Delhi warn that India is in danger of splitting up, that these threats to national integrity must be quashed. But if national integrity is the steel straitjacket, then the remedy is worse than the sickness. Rajnik Attari thinks the so-called threats are vastly exaggerated.
I do not see the Indian state being anywhere in danger. It's a fairly strong state. When it comes to the Sikhs or the Muslims, they really do not constitute a threat. What they represent are demands for greater autonomy for their regions and more participation and more democratic rights.
But there are many Hindus who do view these movements as threats and who want to squash them in the name of Hindu nationalism.
Khalistan will never come in existence, never. No partition of this country will take place hereafter. Not an inch will be given to anybody.
One of the best known is Bal Thackeray, leader of the Shiv Sena, or Sons of the Soil movement in Maharashtra. Thackeray is often labelled a communalist, sometimes a fascist.
My Hindu mission is for that also. It is not only our rights, but it is also to see that the sovereignty of this nation is protected, maintained. Otherwise, this will be a horrible thing, worse than Pakistan.
Many people call Bal Thackeray a Hindu fundamentalist. He isn't. He calls himself a Hindu nationalist, and he represents a growing movement who believe India should be a Hindu state, and there should be an end to pampering the minorities. Ayodhya is a little town in northern India with as many monkeys as there are people. But for devout Hindus, Ayodhya is sacred because it was here, maybe 3,000 years ago, that the legendary god king Ram was born. In the centre of Ayodhya is a small, nondescript mosque, darkened by centuries of humidity. It's said to have been established by Babur, the first Muslim emperor of India. Now, normally, you'd expect to hear the Muslim call to prayer. But inside the mosque, Hindus have installed idols of their deities. And outside, a group of devout Hindu holy men continuously chant bhajans or hymns to the glory of Ram. The Hindu deities and the bhajans are the most obvious sign of the communal dispute that has come to symbolize the bitter and often bloody estrangement between Hindus and Muslims in parts of India. The details of who owns the mosque or temple are less important than the rewriting of Indian history by militant Hindus, such as Ashok Singhal of the Vishwa Hindu Parishad.
450 years back, our temple of Shri Rama Janmabhoomi was desecrated by the invaders. Now it has been a disgrace for the Hindus, a dishonor for the Hindus. We feel that we can bring back our dignity only when we are able to reconstruct this temple.
It's as though Muslims were no longer considered real Indians. Bal Thackeray of the Shiv Sena says that the partition of India in 1947 should have been the end of the affair.
So, Mr. Julian, when that has taken place, the Muslim got their own nation as Pakistan, and we Hindus are here in India, that is Hindustan. Now, in spite of this, because of Mr. Mahatma Gandhi, he had a love for Muslims, and he asked Muslims to stay. They stayed here.
In the past, Bal Thackeray has urged Hindus to throw all Muslims into the Arabian Sea if they refuse to take an oath of loyalty to India. He's willing to give those who want to remain a chance, no more.
We are trying to cooperate, absorb them as far as possible. All Muslims are not traitors. good many Muslims are nationalist-minded Muslims.
Muslims in India, they are our weak blood, weakest blood of Hindus.
B.L. Sharma is secretary of the VHP in Delhi. A retired military man, all spit and polish, with a twinkle in his eye. It's hard to square Sharma's words with his manner, for Sharma believes Muslims have occupied India for over 700 years. It's sometimes unclear whether he thinks Indian Muslims are patriots or whether they should be thrown out of the country and into Pakistan.
No, let them be here. But the mentality should be changed. They always treat that they are the invaders, they are the conquerors. But they should treat Ram, Krishna as national heroes. They must join the mainstream of this country. That's all. We don't want that, they should leave it.
Like most other Hindu nationalists, B.L. Sharma resents what he sees as special treatment for the Muslims. Others turn the equation around in a more positive way.
Instead of taking the view that we withdraw privileges from the minorities, I would much rather extend those privileges to the Hindus also.
Karan Singh is a former minister and diplomat who is sympathetic to the Hindu nationalist argument. Karan Singh argues that Mrs. Gandhi had good political reasons for leaning towards the Hindu nationalist movement.
She had come to realize that an anti-Hindu attitude towards secularism was not going to work in a country where 80% of people are Hindus.
A more cynical observer might conclude that Mrs. Gandhi saw where the votes were and moved accordingly. Her son Rajiv Gandhi tried doing the same thing and ended up angering everyone. Communist rhetoric is spreading. Extremists on both sides talk as though they're quite willing to die for their cause. This is B.L. Sharma of the VHP.
We will lay down our lives, but not yield. It will be unfortunate, of course. But in the course of life, when you have to achieve certain brighter goal, you have to sacrifice certain things. All right, it will be an unfortunate. Let our brothers put their sword and bullet on our chest. We'll take them easy, no problem.
Some extremist Muslims talk the same way. But the real fear of many Muslims is that the Ayodhya controversy has opened up a psychological divide between Hindu and Muslim, greater than anything since partition in 1947. Syed Shahabuddin is a leading Muslim politician who founded the Babri Masjid Action Committee to fight for the preservation of the mosque.
Now, all these things are sort of felt together, and their total impact is that of creating a sense of insecurity, which is cultural, educational, political, economic, and therefore it's almost like a situation of a psychic siege.
Muslims, in fact, enjoy full protection along with all other religious minorities under the constitution. But you might not guess it listening to Shahabuddin.
When the virus in our system explodes into violence, and then of course your name, your face, your identity is like the Star of David, you see, which you must wear on your sleeve.
In the past few years, there have been many violent communal riots. Ahmedabad in 1985, 1986, Meerut in 1987, Bagalpur in 1989, and these are only the most serious. In Ahmedabad, the rioting began over some Hindu medical students feeling cheated by affirmative action programs in favor of minorities. It quickly escalated, and the rioting went on for many months. When I first went there in 1986, the city was nervously quiet. Varis Alvi, a Muslim professor at the local university, was one of the few Muslims prepared to unburden himself.
We are afraid to acknowledge it, to recognize it, to name it. The Indian society, very unconsciously, is becoming a fascist society as far as the communal relationship is concerned. And this fascism is infused into this society And nobody names it as fascism. And this ultimately has resulted into these kinds of riots, and more than the riots, the kind of hatred that is now generally felt, because now everywhere the feeling is that the Muslims are not wanted in this country, and the Muslim is an undesirable element in this country. And this feeling has driven the Muslim community to great despair and desperation.
Do you feel that personally, that you're...
Yeah, personally, I feel very, very much... I feel that I must not live this life. The life has totally become meaningless. Because...
Do you feel threatened?
It's not the threat. But the terror is there. The terrible terror under which the minority is living. And when I talk of myself and my wife and my children and my sisters, it's a constant overhanging terror that they have lived into terror, they have faced the terror, and they are living into the menacing terror that might happen any time. That we live as if we are the dead bodies over here. We have lost the meaning of life, we have lost any sense of security into this world, we have lost any sense of future.
The paradox is that some Hindus also feel threatened, even though they're in the majority. The party most often linked to militant Hinduism is the Bharatiya Janata Party, or BJP. In elections in 1989, it went from hard times to become India's third political party, much of it by playing on this sense of Hindu grievance. L.K. Advani, the party president, says the government always discriminates in favour of the Muslims, and that it's time for Hindus, who make up the vast majority of the population, to take a stand.
My party certainly differs with other political parties for whom the word Hindu has become anathema, who feel that it is all right for a Muslim to be proud of Islam. But the moment a Hindu says that I am proud of Hinduism, he is dubbed as being narrow, fanatic, communal, obscurantist, etc., etc.
For Muslims and most Hindus, those words are often taken to mean an end to the policy of secularism, which in the Indian context means official tolerance for all religions, no matter how tiny or obscure. For Muslims, giving in to militant Hindus on this issue opens up the nightmare of the bloody partition of 1947, where hundreds of thousands lost their lives. Shahid Siddiqui is publisher of the Muslim leftist newspaper Nai Dunya.
The issue is whether India will remain a secular country or it will become a communal state, a Hindu Rashtra. Whether India will remain democratic or democracy will, you know, wither away or will be destroyed.
So both Hindus and Muslims feel they're being discriminated against. This makes it hard for any government to avoid angering one or the other community. The fear is that the belief that unity derives from tolerance of each other's differences and recognition of each other's truths may be fading. The hope is that people come to their senses. 3 years after my initial conversation with Waris Alvi, I met him again in Ahmedabad.
Whole city was so much, had so much become like a ghost city. And the business and all the life was so much paralyzed. But once again the city has started humming, the people realize how much the riots have cost them. Everybody has the feeling. I mean, the citizens of the city, see, give out the feeling that the life of the city should continue, should not be stopped. What foolishness, what madness, that all the city is dead. Once again, they have tasted the full beauty of the peace between the two communities. They have realized that that was something.
Thank you. If this is possible in Ahmedabad, who knows what could be possible in Punjab and Kashmir and throughout northern India? The total number of deaths from communal riots is only a fraction of what it was in the 1960s, for instance. But the damage to trust and mutual respect, the psychological divide, is now far greater. That is the fear, that it may be too wide to be bridged by love and affection.
The tensions occur between, particularly between the dominant castes and the Harijans, the scheduled castes, you see. Because formerly these fellows were all, the Harijans were dependent on the dominant castes in some way or another. Couple of acres of land that would be leased out to them, or they would be working as farm laborers or bonded laborers and so on, you see.
M.N. Srinivas is the Dean of Indian Sociologists. He spent a lifetime studying changes in India's countryside. Mahatma Gandhi campaigned for an end to discrimination against the untouchables, the Harijans. Although things are much better, in some states, such as the very conservative state of Bihar, caste tensions between landowners and the landless labourers who work their land dominate local politics and lead to constant tensions.
These ties are breaking. And the Harijans, the scheduled castes, have alternative sources of employment. And also, they have had access to education. And they no longer tolerate the old idiom of relationship, you see. And if there's an exchange of words, two groups of people start banding abuse at each other, what will happen is, a few days later, a band of toughs from the dominant caste will go and beat up these Harijans, rape their women, set fire to their huts and get back.
In the old days, that might have been the end of the story, unreported by the newspapers. Today, things have changed.
The newspapers report it, television will come into it. Today, it's a media event, you see. Questions are asked in the state legislature and in parliament, and then, you know, the police come in there and arrest the offenders and so on.
Well, sometimes. Often they're hand in glove with the landlords, upholding the sanctity of private property. In Bihar, caste wars have left hundreds killed. It does happen sporadically elsewhere, but it's in Bihar that the problem has really boiled over. And caste tensions are made worse by affirmative action policies. Back in 1947, the government decided to introduce affirmative action or reservation programs for Harijans, tribals and other so-called backward castes. Quotas in the civil service, the army, schools, scholarships right across the board were reserved for these groups. D.N. Mittal, former speaker of the Uttar Pradesh State Assembly in Lucknow, thinks the reservation policy has become a sacred cow.
No attempt had been made to do away with that reservation for 10 years. It was a temporary provision in the constitution, but we had made it permanent almost, extending it by years. Now it's 40 years that we are having it. Because no political party is able to do away with.
Rajnik Kotari says the whole reservation business can sometimes take on comic proportions.
Because every community is saying, give us the status of backwardness, therefore we get certain privileges. Without being backward, you're getting no privileges. Without being branded backward. Backward to the 21st century.
Caste wars, of course, are also class wars, as everyone struggles to get a bigger piece of the economic pie. In the cities, caste barriers are breaking down. If you want to have a quick lunch, you don't have time to check who cooked the food, or who's driving the bus or sitting next to you. In housing, it's a different story, and people have often likened Delhi to a conglomeration of little ethnic villages, each of the castes living in its own little neighbourhood. Politically, caste is very important. Candidates are often chosen to appeal to particular castes, just like Chicago or New York candidates are chosen for their ethnic appeal. For years, the system worked, but now the Harijans have formed their own party, and the old system of vote banks based on particular castes may be breaking down. The The Indian genius has always lain in being able to accommodate pluralities and allow small groups to run their own affairs. Some think that if India is to live with all these ethnic and religious and social tensions, it can only do so if power flows back from New Delhi to the states and from the states to the towns and villages. Easy to say, difficult to put in practice. Politicians and bureaucrats almost by definition cling to their turf. There have been many attempts to devolve and decentralize, to bring Gandhi's vision of Ram Raja, of self-reliant and self-governing villages, into practice. Most of them borrow the name, but not the substance. Madrahalli is a small village in a drought-stricken part of Karnataka. It's a poor area with little irrigation water. If the monsoon fails, people go hungry during the long winter months. A few years ago, Karnataka began a bold experiment to shift 30% of the state's budget and 50% of the state bureaucracy to village and district assemblies, directly answerable to the villagers. M.M. Tramya is the village member of the local council called a Mandal Panchayat.
The urgent need at the time was the drainage, the roads, the street lights, and the houses for the people, and also loans for the poor.
Now, if you hadn't had the system of Mandal Panchayat, where you'd been able to ask for these things, how long would it take you to have got those things normally?
We have been trying past 25 years, but nothing was done much. But immediately after the inception of the system, we have been able to get certain things done immediately.
For the first time, the villagers feel they have a stake in their own development. At the very least, their complaints will now be heard, because their representatives are not big shots living 100 miles away in Bangalore, but right here in the village. But it remains to be seen if this will really change the power structure. Most untouchables are landless labourers, and if they vote against the interests of their landlords, they may lose their jobs. Narayan Swamy, chairman of Bangalore Rural Zilla Parishad, or District Council, knows full well that this experiment called Panchayati Raj can be gutted simply if the state government doesn't really believe in it.
Our experience in India in Panchayat Raj shows that these institutions are introduced with great fanfare, with great publicity. Over the years, they die away. They fade away because powers are taken away, finances are taken away, then they just disappear.
Rajiv Gandhi used to talk about putting computers in all of India's 500,000 villages, reporting directly back to a supercomputer in New Delhi. Narayan Swamy says that's crazy and shows that Rajiv simply never understood what power to the people really means.
It is only the people who can govern themselves at the grassroots level. A centralized system of administration, however efficient that may be, will not be suitable for a vast country like India for rural development.
Vasali is a small village of just 200 inhabitants, also in Karnataka. Vasali is about 1,000 miles south of New Delhi and the cocktail circuits of political gossip. Average weekly wage, $12. Poor, but not at the bottom of the pile. Vasali has one huge advantage, water, and plenty of it from a nearby reservoir. Many people make the mistake of thinking Indian peasants in villages like Vasali aren't really interested in politics, or that candidates can buy them off. I know of many villages where bribes have been offered and accepted, but the peasants just pocketed the money and voted how they wanted. Some of the voters in Vasali are not sure who's prime minister in New Delhi, but when it comes to politics, there's no lack of interest, and what starts out as a simple conversation with one man quickly escalates into a lively political debate.
Now, who do you want to see in power in Delhi?
Karnataka.
Whoever comes there at the center, it makes very different, little difference for us. But what we want is, We want somebody who can do some good for our villagers in the state. Whether it is Congress or Janata or Janata Dal.
So when the politicians come here to try and get your votes, is it because they promise you the earth or because they're honest?
ಓಟು ತಕೊಳ್ಳುಕ ಅಂತ ಬರ್ತಾರೆ ಸೊನ್ನೆ ಓಟು ಹಾಕೋದ್ಮೇಲೆ ಅವ್ರ್ಯಾರು ನೀವ್ಯಾರು ನೀವ್ಯಾರು ಅಂದ್ರೆ ಗುರುತು ಪರಿಚಯ ಮಾಡ್ತಾ ಇದ್ದಾರೆ ಅವ್ರ ಮೇಲೆ.
ನಾರ್ಮಲಿ ಡ್ಯೂರಿಂಗ್ ದಿಸ್ ಅಸೆಂಬ್ಲಿ ಎಲೆಕ್ಷನ್ಸ್ ದ ಪೊಲಿಟಿಷಿಯನ್ಸ್ ಕಮ್ ಓನ್ಲಿ ಬಿಫೋರ್ ದ ಎಲೆಕ್ಷನ್ಸ್ ಟು ಆಸ್ಕ್ ಫಾರ್ ದ ವೋಟ್. ಆಫ್ಟರ್ ದ ಎಲೆಕ್ಷನ್ಸ್ ವಿ ಹವ್ ನಾಟ್ ಸೀನ್ ಸೋ ಫಾರ್ ಎನಿ ಪೊಲಿಟಿಷಿಯನ್ ಆರ್ ಎಲೆಕ್ಟೆಡ್ ಮೆಂಬರ್ ಕಮಿಂಗ್ ಬ್ಯಾಕ್ ಟು ದಿ ಕಾನ್ಸ್ಟಿಟ್ಯೂಯನ್ಸಿ ಅಂಡ್ ಮೀಟಿಂಗ್ ಅಸ್ ಟ್ರೈಂಗ್ ಟು ಅಂಡರ್ಸ್ಟ್ಯಾಂಡ್ ದ ಪ್ರಾಬ್ಲಮ್ಸ್.
ಅಂಡ್ ದೇ ಶುಡ್ ಬಿ ಆನೆಸ್ಟ್ ಅಂಡ್ ನಾಟ್ ಕರಪ್ಟ್ ರೈಟ್
ಯೆಸ್ ವೆರಿ ಮಚ್.
ಇವರು ತಗಬೇಕಾದ್ರೆ ಬೇರೆ ಕಡೆ ಹಾಕ್ತೀವಿ
ಒಳಗಡೆ ಎತ್ತಾಗಲ್ಲ
ಎತ್ತಾಕ್ ಬಿಡ್ತೀವಿ.
ಯು ನೋ ಇಫ್ ಹಿ ಡಸಂಟ್ ಡು ಎನಿಥಿಂಗ್ ಗುಡ್ ಟು ಅವರ್ ವಿಲೇಜ್ ವಿ ವಿಲ್ ಥ್ರೋ ಹಿಮ್ ಇನ್ ಟು ದ ಸ್ಟ್ರೀಮ್ ಅಂಡ್ ವಿ ವಿಲ್ ನಾಟ್ ಸೀ ದಟ್ ಹಿ ವಿಲ್ ಬಿ ಎಲೆಕ್ಟೆಡ್ ಅಗೇನ್.
ಆಫ್ಟರ್ ಎವ್ರಿ ನ್ಯೂ ಎಲೆಕ್ಷನ್ ದರ್ಸ್ ಅ ಟ್ರೆಮೆಂಡಸ್ ಸೆನ್ಸ್ ದಟ್ ಎವ್ರಿಥಿಂಗ್ ಇಸ್ ಪಾಸಿಬಲ್. ದೆನ್ ಪ್ರಾಬ್ಲಮ್ಸ್ ಬಿಕಮ್ ಆಬ್ಸ್ಟಿನೇಟ್, ಗವರ್ನಮೆಂಟ್ಸ್ ಬಿಕಮ್ ಆಂಕ್ಷಸ್ ಪ್ಯಾರನಾಯ್ಡ್, ದ ಕಂಟ್ರೀಸ್ ಎಲೀಟ್ ಸಿಂಕ್ ಇನ್ ಟು ಫ್ಯಾಷನಬಲ್ ಗ್ಲೂಮ್ ಅಂಡ್ ಡೂಮ್. They start prophesying the end of Indian democracy. Elections are called. The pundits are convinced that the government, through its control of the media, will be able to hoodwink the illiterate and ignorant Indian, handing out bribes and goodies, appealing to fear of the unknown. And yet every time, as if to confound the doomsday prophets, the stubborn, slow, poverty-stricken, illiterate Indian rises to the occasion and reminds the elites that intelligence and integrity have nothing to do with income, status, or literacy. Quite why anyone should be surprised is a different matter. After all, over 3,500 odd years, Indians have learnt more than a few things about human nature.
Ram Rajya, In Search of Democracy, was written and produced by Julian Crandall-Hollick and Dean Capello. Production assistants in India were Rana Behel, Raja Chatterjee and Kemba Raju. Pradeep Krishan and Akbar Zaheer were the actors. The theme music was composed and performed by Shubha Shankaran. Consultants to this program were Lloyd and Suzanne Rudolph of the University of Chicago and T.N. Madden of the Institute of Economic Growth. For more information,